wired up. There you go. Stick that someplace so it won't fall off. What time is it? In 1 more minute. So you came here with a minute to spare.
How's the volume on this mic? Okay?
Yeah, you can turn it, you can adjust it. So I get to have my breakfast. Yeah, and then, just go till you're done, and then I'll come up, and I got a little cookie quiz for you.
Sure. Thanks, Richard. So my name's Graham Hickling. I'm a New Zealander, which is why I speak funny. And I'm trained as a wildlife biologist. But one of the things that got me really interested when I arrived here in Tennessee was the interface between wildlife, humans, and disease. So that's kind of the theme of the talk. But I wanted to start by asking you guys a question. How many of you like horror movies? How many of you don't like horror movies? And the rest of you have no opinion. Well, that's sad. As a hobby, I make movies. And so, like, make little home movies with my graduate students, things like that. And horror movies is a really good theme, because you don't really have to act. You just have to scream a lot and run and panic. So I've thought a lot about, you know, what are the themes that you get in horror movies? And I mean, there are some obvious ones, you know, the crazed slasher. Zombies are a big theme at the moment. But there are some other ones that I find in some ways more interesting. And so, for example, we have the werewolf. So the werewolf goes back a long way in cultural history. This idea of transformation.
We lost your protector.
Ooh.
Not quite. What happened? It was on there. There you go.
Okay, so, you know, werewolves are interesting because of the connection to wildlife. So you have this fear in our human psyche of large predators, and in Europe that was particularly wolves. But also there's a whole lot of cultural baggage to that. The werewolf kind of symbolizes, you know, transformation, puberty. There's a whole lot of kind of baggage going on there. But there is a wildlife connection. And so another horror movie theme are vampires. So what's the real world vampire? Because there is one. Bats. Okay, so not the bats we have here in the US, but down in Mexico and further south, there are bats that literally will come and, if you're asleep, potentially suck your blood. They do that more to cows than to people, but, you know, I guess we taste okay. So again, there's kind of like a wildlife theme there. There's been a series of movies. The first one I remember going to was Outbreak back in 1995. But, you know, since then we've had 12 Monkeys. And then last year we had Contagion. Now the theme of all of those, the inciting incident, is that there is a crossover of disease from wild animals to humans. And then there's an outbreak and we all get sick and we run around screaming and it's the end of the world. So that's all good stuff. But think about the wildlife connection there. The idea that sitting out in the wild animals are nasty bugs, bacteria, viruses, that can cross over to us. We're not adapted to them. When we get sick with them, everybody dies and runs around screaming. So what I want to talk about today is not horror movies, but is ticks. So they're not as big, they're not as ferocious, they're not as charismatic, but actually they're probably a more real risk to folks here in Tennessee than vampires or zombies or werewolves. Not sure about the kind of knife-wielding, psychotic chainsaw. We might have a few of them too, but let's talk about ticks today. And part of the reason I think this is a good lecture for this class is it illustrates a more general point that we have natural systems out there that, although they're not out to get us, they have kind of a light side and a dark side. And so the dark side in this case is the potential for disease transmission. And the theme, as it relates to this class, is kind of nature out of balance. Like all of these systems have been there longer than humans have been in North America, but we've added ourselves to the system and we've changed the system. And as we do that, the issues I'll talk about today are an example of the kind of problems that emerge when we change things and screw things up. The broader theme and kind of my role here at the university is we have a Center for Wildlife Health. It's based in the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Wildlife, where Dr. Strange and I work. But the idea is it's multidisciplinary. And that's because you have this idea of interlocking circles. So here's the diagram we often use. You've got the wildlife, which is what we study in our department, but you've got humans, you've got domestic animals, and you've got the overlap, and one of those overlaps is disease transmission, and then all of those circles are surrounded by a bigger circle that's the environment that I was talking about just before. And so at a university, to study that kind of problem, you need lots of different departments involved. You need the microbiologists, you need the vets, you need the GIS people that can map landscapes, you need somebody that knows about wildlife, you need somebody that knows about vector-borne insects and arthropods and ticks. So that's kind of the theme. I think it's a great kind of thing to do at a university. We encourage our grad students to do these kinds of projects. We have undergrad courses. So that's my little PR blurb. So let's use ticks as an example. Okay, well the example starts not with the ticks, but with the big wildlife, deer. Okay, now there used to be, in the past, before we did a lot of hunting, deer pretty much everywhere, forests pretty much everywhere. And then about 100 years ago, we really started changing the deer forest ecosystem. And the story I'm telling you is how that has led with a whole lot of flow-on consequences to some disease issues. So what did we do? Well, basically, in the early days of settlement, we shot a heck of a lot of deer. So they were very heavily harvested. We also logged a lot of forests. A lot of the early cities in the US were built out of wood, and the wood came from the trees got chopped down. So those two things in combination, shooting the population at a higher rate than it could sustain, and logging the forests where the deer and other critters lived, led to a huge population decline in deer. And so that by about 100 years ago, in a lot of heavily populated areas, deer were really rare. I was working up in Michigan. I remember hearing a story in the 1930s, one of the newspaper headlines was, you know, deer seen in, I don't know, can't remember which county it was, but you know, it was kind of like headline news to see a deer. Okay, that's 50 years ago, 100 years ago. What's happened since? Well, everybody took a look around and said, we're not managing this wildlife resource properly. So wildlife management courses started being developed. People started getting trained in it. The agency started bringing in hunting regulation, bag limits, season limits, stopping poaching, whatever the word for that is. And so these guys that used to be able to shoot this number of deer in a weekend moved into a new much more managed paradigm. And what that did to the deer population is in that line. So you can see that starts in the 1940s. This is data for Michigan, but I've got almost exactly the same data for here in Tennessee. You can see 1960s, it's still low. And then we go into this real exponential increase. So those of you that have done kind of like basic population biology, where you have the idea of exponential curves, if there's no limit on growth, everything doubles and doubles and doubles, and the curve starts skyrocketing. So that's what deer populations have done in the last several decades. Now, the reason I'm talking about deer is that deer are one of the main food supplies for adult ticks. So the way this works is that male and female ticks get together on deer, have a good meal and mate. So you can think of deer as being kind of like the cruise liners of the tick world, where they sort of like hang out and get it on. And the deer blood that goes into the female tick, she fills up like a grape full of deer blood, that gets converted into the next generation of ticks, about 2,000 eggs. Okay, so each female on the deer drops off into the leaf litter, goes through the winter, and produces a clutch of 2,000 new baby ticks. So the increase in the deer population has light side and dark side. The light side is, if you like wildlife viewing, you can see more deer. If you like hunting, you can shoot more deer. But they start eating your grandmother's roses in her backyard. They start jumping in front of your Prius when you smack into it. And Prii are not very robust to deer vehicle collisions. They tend to come off worse than the deer often. And we get an increase in tick populations because you have all these cruise liners with all these mating ticks getting their blood meal and dropping off. So let's talk a little bit about ticks. Let me get rid of that little box too, sorry. It's really annoying. Okay, so as deer numbers built up, tick numbers have exploded, and that's led to disease. And up there, I've just got three examples of diseases. And so one of the take-home messages of this talk is, I mean, how many of you have heard of Lyme disease? Most of you. How many of you have heard of, let's say one that's not up there, like ehrlichiosis? Okay, a lot less of you. Some of you will have heard of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Well, here in Tennessee, the number one tick-borne disease is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. The number two is Ehrlichia, which most of you haven't heard of. And way in third ranking is the occasional case of Lyme disease. So one of the points of the lecture is that this increase in deer has triggered disease, and it's multiple diseases. And we keep finding new ones year by year. Just in the time I've been working here, new outbreaks like heartworm virus had just literally been discovered. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the tick biology that is underpinning that increase. Okay, first point is ticks are not insects. They are more closely related to spiders and crabs and things like that. They have four pairs of legs, whereas an insect has three pairs of legs. They also have two body parts, the prosoma and the opthosoma, whereas an insect has the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. Okay, so ticks are not insects. The main distinguishing feature is the four pairs of legs. Interestingly, there's juvenile ticks, there are larvae and nymphs, and then the adults, and the larval ticks, the baby ticks, they only have three pairs. So if you want to get into kind of like a silly argument with somebody sometime, you can bring that up. My son, who at the time was about 8, got into an argument with his high school teacher because she was saying, ticks have four pairs of legs. He's going, but they don't always. And she's going, quiet down. And he was indignant that she hadn't listened to him. The one other feature, well, up there we've got the pedipalps and the chelicerae. The pedipalps are sensory organs that the ticks use to orient, to find a host, to figure out where to bite. So they're kind of waving around. The chelicerae are basically the jaws. They're very hard, they're barbed, they dig into you, and I'll show you a close-up later that's a bit scary. The one other feature that's a kind of bit of jargon, but it's worth keeping in mind, is that that black plate on the back is called the scutum. And the reason we pay attention to that is that's the way you sex a tick. That's a female adult, and you can see she has this large rear part. Now that's actually soft tissue, and as the tick feeds, that tissue actually grows. It doesn't stretch, it grows. Extra cells get added on, and that gives the room to enlarge to fill up with blood. And the fact that it's actually growing is why ticks feed for a long time. They typically, an adult can feed for 3 to 7 days if it doesn't get pulled off. So that's completely different from something like a mosquito. A mosquito's abdomen, it's an insect, so it has an abdomen, that just swells up, just stretches. But these guys grow a bigger rear end to fit all the blood in. The males don't have that bit below the scutum. Their rear end is bounded by the edge of the scutum. So that's how you sex them. So here's some examples. Whoops, no, I'll come to the examples in a minute. Okay, so I said that ticks feed on the deer and drop off. And so that's the point here. 90% of the life of a tick, at least these, we're talking about the hard ticks. There's another group called soft ticks, but all the ones that we encounter here in Tennessee are the hard ticks. They feed for a brief time, up to 7 days, and then they drop off, and then they're down in the leaf litter. The eggs hatch, turn into baby ticks called the larvae. That larvae feeds on a mouse or a bird, gets a blood meal, it molts, becomes a nymph, a teenage tick. It hangs out in the leaf litter, finds a bird or a mouse or a lizard, feeds, molts, becomes the adult. So they feed on 3 hosts during their lifetime, 3 meals, that's it, spaced out over at least a couple of years, and all the rest of the time they're down in the leaf litter. Just these brief periods on the host. But the brief period on the host is when disease transmission happens. How do they find the host? Depends on the tick species. So the most common tick here in Tennessee, the Lone Star tick, I'll show you a photo in a minute, it's a very active host-seeking tick. It senses movement, it senses heat, it senses CO2. And so if you sit down in the middle of the woods in the middle of summer, they will come towards you reasonably rapidly, and they will climb up. A video that I want to have for this class, and I just haven't got around to doing it, is put out a block of dry ice with a time-lapse camera, and as the CO2 evaporates, you just get a sea of ticks coming in and getting all over the ice. It's kind of cool. The tick that spreads Lyme disease, the deer tick, which officially is called the black-legged tick, it doesn't do most of those things. It doesn't have eyes. That's a black-legged tick there. It does not have eyes, so it can't see you. It doesn't approach you. It sits and waits. It hangs up on a bit of leaf like that until you brush past. And then on the end of its limbs, it has kind of a Velcro effect. Just these little hooks. Well, it doesn't jump on you. It just reaches out and just caresses you. And those hooks latch it on. And then once it's latched on, it navigates around to a nice, soft, humid place where it can bite. We use that behavior to survey how abundant ticks are. And so here's one of my graduate students. This is called dragging. So you get a square of corduroy, you walk a standard number of paces, reasonably slowly, and at the end of that, you pick up the drag cloth, and you will get a count of the ticks on it. And so we do a lot of our surveys for what time of year ticks are active, where they're active, differences between states, by doing that kind of standardized survey. Okay, so here's the slide I thought I was coming to before. Here's 3 species of ticks. On the top, you've got the females, and on the bottom, you've got the males. And so it's a little hard to see on this one. Actually, it's hard to see on all of them. But you can see with the females, the scutum comes about halfway back. The males, the scutum comes right to the back here. Okay, so in their adult form, ticks are sexually dimorphic. There's males and females. Who knows what that species is? Someone call it out. Black-legged tick or the deer tick? This one? the Lone Star tick. Okay, now the female is really easy to tell because it's got the white dot that gives it its name. But this guy, the male, does not have the white dot. And so one of the things that, you know, my students will come in and say to me, hey, we were out hiking in the weekend, we got covered in black-legged ticks, and this is in July. And I'm going, are you sure? And they went, yeah, we know what a Lone Star tick looks like. What they're mixing up is this guy with one of these guys. They didn't see the white spot, they could tell it was an adult, so they figured it must be a deer tick. But it's not, it's the male. And the reason that I know that they've got it wrong is that these ticks have different seasonal cycles. So the adults of these are active now. They are a fall, winter, spring adult species. These guys start off in the kind of mid-spring and then go through the summer, or at least the early part of the summer. Who knows what the last one is? That's the American dog tick. Okay, that one is also active pretty much through the summer. This is the one that your pets tend to bring in. If you've ever had a pet, if you've ever had a tick indoors climbing around on the carpet, and if you have a cat or a dog, chances are that's the species that came in with it. So these are the three tick species that you'll encounter in the woods. Now there are a whole bunch of other tick species out there, but they don't ever bite humans. They're like woodchuck ticks or chipmunk ticks or bird ticks. These are the human biting species in the woods. There's also a couple of other species that I won't talk about today just to keep it simple, but there's a German dog tick that's associated with kennels and things like that. And there's another closely related species to this called the Gulf Coast tick that you just really occasionally get in Tennessee, but it's not common. Now, just a little bit of jargon. Each of these has a different Latin name. So this is Ixodes scapularis, Amblyomma americanum, and Dermacenta variabilis. So you'll hear people talking about Ixodes ticks, Amblyomma, and Dermacenta, and that's what they're meaning. Now, the reason I want to at least get you thinking about recognizing different tick species is each species carries a different set of pathogens, a different set of viruses and bacteria. So the tick species that bites you is a really good diagnostic for what you might be sick with. And if there's no other take-home message from this course, it's probably that one. Okay, so that kind of raises the issue of it would be good to be able to identify ticks. When you see them up kind of big like that, well lit, they really look pretty different. They really look different. I mean, the female Ixodes has this red abdomen. And you can just see that on a drag cloth. I mean, you can just tell. This guy has smooth at the back. This has what's called festoons, this kind of wiggliness. So these ones, you know, with characteristics like that that you can get your eye in for, are really pretty easy. The female's easy up there. The Dermacenta are kind of distinctly different as well. So the only other complication to identification, well, there's a couple of other complications. One is they change shape when they fill up with blood. Okay, so this is called engorgement. So an unfed tick, a partly fed tick, a fully fed tick. Okay, these are dog ticks, again, the same sequence. You can see they can really get quite large. And here's a very sad looking puppy. Okay, so a lot of us, when we see ticks on our animals, on our pets, on our livestock, it's often like that, where they're engorged, and it does get harder to do a species identification when they're like that. And then you have to get a microscope out and look at the mouth parts and things like that. But most of you hopefully won't be seeing the ticks like that because you will have pulled them off you before they get the blood meal. And when they're flat, it's easier. So that's one complication, that ticks can get hard to tell apart when they're full of blood. The other complication is the life stages. So here's a little sketch of that. Here's the same three species. Black-legged ticks, Ixodes. Lone Star ticks, Amblyomma. Dog ticks, Dermacenta. The female and the male. And then the teenage ticks, which are the nymphs. and the baby ticks, which are the larvae. Okay, think of it like the alphabet. L comes before N. So, in the middle of summer, you're out wandering in the woods, you brush against a bush, and suddenly you've got moving dirt on your arm or your leg. You look down and there's just this mass of like brown seething little things. Seed ticks. Okay, seed ticks are these guys. They're the larvae of the Lone Star. And the reason you've got this whole clump of them is that they've just hatched out of the egg mass, so there's 2,000 of them sitting on that one branch. Except now they're sitting on your arm or your leg. Okay? If we talk about Lyme disease, up in the Northeast, where Lyme disease is very common, it's a summer disease. But I just told you those black-legged ticks, the ones that spread Lyme disease, the adults are winter active. Well, that's right. It turns out the main transmitting life stage for Lyme disease is the teenage black-legged tick, the nymph. And it is summer active, when everybody's out in the parks wearing shorts, wearing short sleeve shirts, rolling around in the grass doing who knows what. So it does get a little bit more complicated. These guys are small. There's three main species, and there's four life stages. I should say the nymphs and the larvae are not sexually differentiated. There's not a male or female at that point. So there's 12 combinations to learn. And it took me a while. It took me a while to learn them all. But the one thing I would say for those of you that are wildlife students or know a wildlife students, how many minnows are there in Tennessee? I don't know. Richard, Dr. Strange, how many?
A
couple of dozen minnows. To me, they all freaking look the same. How many little brown birds are there that all the bird watchers get super excited about and can tell apart? I can't tell them apart. So I feel like telling 12 combinations of tick where there's big size differences is not beyond us. I think it would be a good thing to kind of strive towards at least. So I get really mad when people start mixing up tick species, and I'll give you an example of that a little bit later. I'm not going to get into this because it's a bit complicated, but that's just repeating what I said about how you have the eggs turn into larvae, feed on a small critter, molt into nymphs, feed on something bigger, including us, turn into the male and the female, hang out on the deer, get it on, produce more eggs. So that's the life cycle. And it typically takes a couple of years. So think about that. These ticks are out there. They are probably longer lived than a mouse. The typical mouse is like the potato chip of the ecosystem. If they last 6 months, they're doing well. They get eaten by something or whatever. Most ticks are living a couple of years. Think about a mosquito. A mosquito, I don't even know how long a mosquito lasts. Maybe a couple of weeks? And so that's why ticks are really great at transmitting diseases, because they get several opportunities to pick up pathogens from these hosts they feed on, and then they're around for a long time, having an opportunity to spread it back to another host, including us. So I'm not sure why I'm smiling, because on my arm I have a little black-legged tick biting me. And so that's just to kind of point out, these guys are really small. The teenage ticks are much smaller than the adults, they're easy to miss. If you've got one up in your hairline or behind your ear or wherever. Okay, so let's talk about what happens when this guy bites me. Okay, well, the first thing is they are using their jaws, their chelicerae, to get into you. And so you can see that's, you know, the structure of the chelicerae over on the right there. And it's split in half. And so it's almost like it's this kind of action. They go like that, and with the barbs, it just gets them further and further in each time. So the barbs help it penetrate and also resist them being pulled out again. And then the other thing they do is they secrete a kind of cement. So once they're in there, they actually glue themselves to you. And the reason they're doing that is they want to be able to stay there for 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. They've really got to have a firm attachment. And so the advice that we give for getting rid of a tick is get a fine pair of forceps and grab it as close as you can to the skin, because down here, this is the top part of the chelicerae. That is really hard. It's like a little splinter. You can grab it and you can pull, and then the whole thing comes out. If you grab a tick higher up, that's just soft tissue. And two things will happen. First thing is that you will squish all the tick juices back into you, and that's bad. The other thing that will happen is it will rip, and the top part will come off, and it will leave that chelicerae stuck in you. So even if you haven't picked up a bacteria, it's like having a, you know, a rose thorn or whatever. It's unpleasant, and you could potentially get just a secondary infection. So you grab the tick here, and you just lift straight up. Now there's a whole web full of urban legends about how to pull ticks out. Putting Vaseline on the back, cigarette lighter. And I was like, God, who would do that? And I was talking to an old friend. I did my PhD up in Canada. There were lots of ticks in the Rockies. And they said, you know, what are you talking about, dude? You did exactly that. You used a lighter on your armpit to try and get a tick off. And I'm going, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you were extremely drunk at the time. So I have no recollection of that, but I think he's telling the truth. So I'm as bad as anybody else. But the point is, the Vaseline, the cigarette lighter, the soapy cotton wool that you dab on it, they will only work on a very recently attached tick that has not cemented itself in. And if it hasn't cemented itself in, anything you do will get it off. You could probably flick it off with your fingernail or a credit card. An attached tick, those techniques won't work, because the tick, even if it wanted to pull back, can't do it quickly. It has to use enzymes to break down that cement before it can back out. So just use some forceps. Okay, so here we've got this tick, typically with bacteria and viruses in its gut. And the reason they're in the gut is the way ticks digest stuff is different from the way we do. We have stomach acids and enzymes and things, but ticks actually suck the food into their cells and digest it within the cells. So all that's in the gut is just, you know, the remnants of the blood meal. There's nothing there to hurt a bacteria. It can just sit there. It's a really nice place to kind of wander, hang out in. And what ticks do is they bring in the blood meal, which I think is the next slide, and they concentrate it. So they draw out the nutrients into their cells, they leave the wateriness behind, the serum, and then they backflush, they backwash, and they push that all back into the host. And so at that point, whatever's in the tick gut, which can be multiple species of pathogens, goes back into us. Okay, so in that case, I've drawn the bacteria as little spirals. And that's because that's an illustration of Lyme disease. The Lyme disease bacteria is a spirochete. It's a long, thin, corkscrew-shaped bacteria. And once it gets into you, it's a little bit unusual in that it doesn't hang out in the blood. It bores through your connective tissue. It goes through your skin, through your joints, things like that. It uses the corkscrew to literally bore through you. And it multiplies. The numbers build up as it goes. And so, don't worry about that. Let me just jump. Oh, okay, I'll come back to that boring part in a minute. I've got out of order here. So a couple of points. I said there can be multiple pathogens in the tick. How long does it take to transmit? The common ones in Tennessee, the rickettsias, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, and the ehrlichias, can transmit pretty much instantly. I mean, not instantly, but within like an hour or so of the tick starting to feed. So that's bad. Lyme disease is kind of interesting in that the Lyme disease bacteria in the tick do not start off in a place that they can be backwashed. They're kind of in other parts of the tick. The blood meal activates them and they move. They move into the gut towards the salivary glands, and then they can get backwashed. That process takes a couple of days. And so for people in areas where they have to worry about Lyme disease, that's really good news, because it means if you do a thorough tick check, the same day that you get the tick on you, you have almost zero chance of getting Lyme disease. Okay, we down here in the south are a bit less lucky because these ones we could get kind of before you get home in the evening after a hike. Okay, so I'm starting to talk about more than one kind of bacteria. This is really just to kind of make you depressed. You don't need to learn all the details. But what I'm saying here is each tick species is associated with a suite of pathogens. So those Lone Star ticks, they have a couple of Ehrlichias, a Borrelia, and a Rickettsia. The black-legged ticks has a couple of Borrelias, an Anaplasma, and a Babesia. And each of those causes a different disease. And so, you know, a lot of times when we talk about ticks and disease, everybody's Lyme disease, Lyme disease, Lyme disease. And if you go on the web, it's all about Lyme disease. But my point is, that is just one of those combinations. Lyme disease is the spiral bacteria, Borrelia burgdorferi, transmitted by the black-legged tick, causing the disease. But here in Tennessee, we have all these other combinations to worry about as well. So it's really kind of important to figure out which tick bites you, or which tick does bite people. If you live up in Michigan or Connecticut or New Jersey, which is like this graph is ordered by latitude. So up there we've got Wisconsin, Connecticut. We've got a blue bar and a red bar, and this is the percentage of, it's like which species is biting people. The blue is the black-legged tick, Ixodes. The red is the dog tick, the Dermacentor. Okay? So people get bitten about evenly by dog ticks and black-legged ticks up north. They don't get bitten by the Lone Star ticks because the Lone Star tick distribution doesn't go that far. Lone Stars are a southern tick species. They emerged out of South America and they're kind of moving north. Okay? When you come right down to Kentucky, South Carolina, even Virginia, which is not that far south, almost all the bites are coming from Lone Star ticks. And I don't have Tennessee data up there. Kentucky, Fort Knox is kind of the closest. But other data that we have, 99.9%, and I'm not making that up, I mean it's like 1 in 1,000 tick bites would be the black-legged tick. Almost all the rest are the Lone Stars, because they're just so common here, with a few dog ticks thrown into the mix, particularly people that have pets. Okay, so what that graph is up there to say is the diseases that people in America are at risk from varies dramatically between the North and the South. And so when you go online and learn about, you know, look up tick-borne disease, 90% of the websites up there are all about Lyme disease, and that's why you haven't heard about the things down here in Tennessee like Rickettsias and Ehrlichias. It's kind of very northern-oriented set of information. Okay, so this photo was not taken in Tennessee because that's a black-legged tick biting me, and that almost never happens here. That's taken up in Michigan. So what happens when someone gets a bite? This is not my arm, fortunately. Okay, so this is a bite from a black-legged tick with the spiral Borrelia. And you have this classic symptom called a bullseye rash, an erythema migrans. You get the central red dot where the tick bit, and you get this expanding red ring. And a doctor will kind of classically define it as if it's more than 5 centimeters across, if it's more than a couple of inches across and expanding, that's the classic Lyme disease symptom. And what's happening here is those little spiral bacteria started off at the tick bite, they started multiplying, and they started boring. So they are literally boring out away from that bite point. And the red ring is a measure of how far they've got, because that's where the inflammation is. And then as they move further out, the skin behind them goes whiter again. And that's what gives you this bullseye rash. About 80% of people that get bitten and infected with Lyme disease will get one of these rashes. So it's a good diagnostic, but it's not a foolproof one. Lyme disease is easily treated in the first few weeks after you contract it. You just take doxycycline, tetracycline, a basic antibiotic. It will be fixed in a couple of weeks. Those of you that have heard about this kind of big debate about Lyme disease and the ongoing problems that people have, that is the situation where the early symptoms get missed. Those bacteria spread out further into lots of different organ systems, the spinal cord, the heart, the brain. You start getting much more severe symptoms like, you know, partial paralysis, heart problems, things like that. One of the problems, if you don't see a tick, and if you're one of the 20% of people that don't get the rash, is that if you get a blood test, the blood test is testing for your body's reaction to the bacteria. If you do the blood test too soon, you won't be positive. So a lot of the kind of sad cases of chronic Lyme disease come from people that maybe they did get tested, but they weren't reacting, and then later when the disease flared up was after the test was done. But okay, so we talk about ticks, bite, rash. That's the classic Lyme disease rash, a bullseye rash, at least a couple of inches across and spreading outwards. And you can get multiple of them. They can show up in other parts of the body. Okay, now this one is me, and that's what I get working here in the summer after I get bitten by a Lone Star tick. You get these, like, it's not expanding, it's not large, but it really lasts a long time. So it's not just kind of like a mosquito bite that fades. I've had these that will last like a month. I don't know what's causing that. I think there's some little pathogeny thing that's kind of, your body is fighting off the infection spreading, but right at the bite site, it lasts a long time. But you know, you go into a doctor and they will score that on their medical chart as a rash. Well, it is a rash, but it's really different from the other one. So just like different ticks tell you what disease you've got, different rashes make a difference too. And that is really clear in the case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. That's why it's got its name. In the late stages of that disease, which is caused by a rickettsia, you get that spotted pattern, particularly on the feet and on the palms of your hands. And that's caused by the blood vessels under your skin collapsing. It's like hemorrhagic disease. It's kind of like, you know, Ebola and things like that. And that is very, very bad. You need to be in hospital in intensive care when you are like that, or you are likely to die. And if you are in hospital, you may still die if it gets to that stage. The good news is there's a lot of reports of Rocky Mountain spotted fever here, but there's actually not a lot of real serious cases, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But if you get bitten by a tick and you get a headache and you start getting a fever, go see a doctor, because this progresses pretty fast. And the people that die from this, I think there's been a couple of cases in Tennessee in the last couple of years, so it's not common, but it happens, are people that waited to see if a rash developed. And my point with this one is you don't ever want to see the rash, because it's not an allergic reaction, it's a my body is collapsing reaction. The good news is that most people diagnosed with Rocky Mountain spotted fever here actually don't have this. There are several different rickettsias that live in Tennessee ticks, and the least common one is Rickettsia rickettsii, which causes this disease, and the most common one is Rickettsia amblyommae, which doesn't, as far as we know, cause any disease at all. So again, like, you're really unlikely to get this, but it's serious if you do. One of the problems with all those different rickettsias is it's really challenging for the doctors. If they do a blood test, have you been exposed to rickettsia? You may well have, but it's the one that's not disease causing. And that's why we get so many Rocky Mountain spotted fever reports and so few people that get really sick. And that's kind of a challenge for the medical community to come up with a better test. But again, basically my point is, There are rashes, and there are rashes, and there are rashes. There are the bullseyes, there are those amblyoma ones, and then there's that, and they are all very different. And they mean different patterns of infection. Okay, so I'm going to finish off the lecture by just talking about the ecological side of this. And the reason we need to talk about that is all of these diseases are on the increase. And that freaks the Center for Disease Control out, because the Center for Disease Control down in Atlanta is supposed to be making diseases go away. They want to see declining rates, declining prevalences. But you know, here's a graph of Rocky Mountain spotted fever reports in Tennessee, and a steep climb in recent years. Here's a graph for the country as a whole of Ehrlichia, a couple of different types of Ehrlichia, 86 through to 97 in the last decade. A big increase. And here's, again, the national total for Lyme disease. And this one, if you look at the axis, the other ones were like hundreds. This is tens of thousands. Most of them up in the Northeast and the Midwest. But this is the worst vector-borne disease in the US. There's no mosquito-borne disease. You know, West Nile virus, things like that, have way, way fewer cases than there are of Lyme disease. And a trend line like that makes CDC really anxious, because it's kind of like, that's not the way it's supposed to be going. So what's driving this? The thing that I started the lecture with, habitat change and wildlife change, particularly deer. So let's talk about that. That one's kind of out of place, but that's just again to say, the human cases of Lyme disease are coming from the teenage ticks. Teenage ticks are really small. You really have to look carefully for them. Okay, so, embarrassing photo. Just before I talk about that ecological part, I just wanted to give you an illustration of why tick identification is important and gets screwed up. A couple of years ago, I got interviewed by the local TV station. They phoned up in the spring. They said, we're getting reports that there are a lot of ticks around. Can you comment on whether there are more ticks this year? And I said, yes, I can, because we do regular surveys. I can compare this year with last year. So that was all good. They came along, they interviewed me outside, you know, in the garden, and I told them a few things and showed them how we drag ticks and so on. And then I gave a spiel, kind of not dissimilar from what I just gave now, talking about, you know, human biting ticks, how Lone Star ticks are the really common tick, blah, blah, blah. I didn't ask the really important question I should have asked, which is, so like, what's sort of the theme of your story, and who else are you talking to? Because right after I gave my little blurb, they interviewed someone else who was a vet. And she was talking about how people are getting lots of ticks on their pets, and lots of ticks indoors, and they went and interviewed a dog owner at a kennel. Remember how I said there was this other tick species, the brown dog tick, that isn't out in the woods, but is on dogs and is in kennels? So that was the species she was talking about. Okay, and then they started talking about Lyme disease, which neither of us had even mentioned, because the dog ticks don't spread Lyme disease. And while talking about Lyme disease, they put up that photo, which is the Lone Star tick, which doesn't spread Lyme disease. And so I'm sitting there watching this kind of train wreck of an interview going, man, that just made things even worse. And one of the things I had said to the journalist, and in fact, every time I get interviewed, I say to the journalist, is like, can you please make the point that there's more than one tick species and they spread different diseases? And I just, you know, silly me, but I just feel like that is not rocket science to get that concept across. There's more than one tick species. They always say, it's too complicated. We can't put that in the story. It's too complicated. And so the story comes out, it's just like ticks, ticks, ticks. It drives me crazy. Yesterday, I was checking the weather. The Weather Channel, one of their, you know, top trending stories or something like that. I just saw it off on the sidebar, I clicked it, it's about Lyme disease. But I don't know if you can see, you probably can't see actually, but the tick they're illustrating it with is a dog tick, which does not spread Lyme disease. But it's the tick that's in people's carpets because it comes in with their dogs. So that's going to freak everybody out about something that they shouldn't be freaked out about. So if nothing else from this class, like that's a really good take-home message, is just when you're talking to somebody, get a sense of, you know, well, which tick is it we're actually talking about? Okay, ecology. How am I doing for time?
About, let's see, less than 10 minutes.
Okay, so just to finish off, ecological factors that is driving these increases. Okay, the first one is what I've talked about. Habitat and land use change leads to increases in the hosts that the ticks feed on. And I talked about deer, and in the case of deer, the added factor there is hunting management. But it's not just deer, you know, and the flow-on effect to ticks. Not just deer. So bobcats in Tennessee. Bobcat populations are on the rise. That's harvest data. Bobcats carry the dog tick, even though it's a cat. And bobcats also carry a bacteria called, actually, I can't remember what the bacteria is called, but the disease it causes is cytoxizoonosis. Now, that's a disease of domestic cats. It's a rare disease, except in Middle Tennessee, in the last few years, we've suddenly been getting all these domestic cats starting to suddenly get this disease. And so we hypothesize, no one studied this yet, it'd be a good grad student project, but we hypothesize that the rise in the bobcats, the rise in those ticks, has created this new disease risk for pet cats. Coyotes. Coyotes are on the increase right through the eastern states. They've kind of migrated westward, sorry, eastward from the west. Again, the coyotes carry the dog ticks, and they carry rickettsia. And rickettsia is the causal agent of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which is on the increase. Now, these ticks are potentially on deer as well, so it's not like it's just one thing. But what I'm saying is it's a multi-species problem. You have all these different hosts, a number of which are increasing at the moment. Okay, so that's the first factor. The second factor that you hear a lot of talk about is climate change. Ticks are cold-blooded little critters. Where they can live is determined by the weather. They don't have the opportunity to, you know, keep themselves warm. But at least here in Tennessee, I really don't think that's an issue, because Tennessee is right slap bang in the middle of the distributional ranges of all these ticks we've talked about. They go down into South America, and they go north to about the Canadian border. So where climate change is important is probably on the northern limit, that ticks that used to be just, you know, just not quite into Canada in the last couple of decades have moved maybe about 50 miles north. Doesn't seem like much, but 50 miles north, if you know the Canadian border, that's, you know, Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, Ottawa, Kingston. Most of the Canadian population is within about 50 miles of the border. So it's actually a huge change in terms of public health. But it's not really important down here. And there, remember I said the Lone Star ticks is what mainly bites us? You see, they go north, but not as far north as some of the other tick species. So if you live in somewhere like, I don't know, Indiana, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and coming up the coast there, climate change might be having an effect there for you, and it's putting you in range of the Lone Stars. But they are, Lone Stars are well entrenched here in Tennessee. Okay, and then the final big driver is our behavior. We put ourselves at risk of tick bites by getting out there in the environment. So here's just a quick example that one of my grad students studied. In Crossville, there are a number of retirement communities which advertise themselves as golf-oriented. And it basically means that big blocks of forest, the bulldozers came in, put in a golf course, put in a fairway, the greens. And then you can see, I think in the back, there's some houses. So a lot of the people are just living in these retirement communities right around that habitat. And so that has generated disease outbreaks. And that particular case was the biggest outbreak of Ehrlichia in elderly golfers that there had ever been in the States, to the point that CDC did an outbreak investigation. And they came in and they looked at risk factors. And, you know, the things that put those community people at risk were, did they play golf? Did they live close to the edge of the greenway? Because what's happening here is, you know, the deer are coming back and forwards to feed on the nice green grass, and the ticks are just lurking on this edge. And I had heard about the study before I ever came to the States, because one of the risk factors that CDC found was golf handicap. They found that if you are a lousy golfer, you are more at risk of disease. And why would that be? You whack the ball into the woods and you go after it. And the reason I'd heard about that is that I had some friends who are doctors, and doctors thought that was the most amazing scientific study ever done, because it essentially said to protect yourself, you need to practice more golf and get better and not hit the ball into the woods anymore. And they thought that was a very good prescription to be able to give their patients. Okay, so this putting ourselves in harm's way is really relevant to Tennessee. That's a headline. You know, we like living out in the suburbs, the exurbs, with the woods around us, with the ticks and the deer and the mice all around us as well. And so that's a real characteristic of a lot of where we live here in Tennessee. Just really briefly, I've already said this, but here's the pie graph. What tick-borne diseases get reported here? Most of the reports are SFG, stands for spotted fever group rickettsiosis. So that's all of the rickettsias, one of which is Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There's lots of reports, but only a small part is probably the really bad one. Second is ehrlichiosis, which most of you hadn't heard of. And third is Lyme disease. So ehrlichiosis is probably one of the main concerns here. This is a graph of which ticks bite you. Again, just to repeat what I said before, most tick bites come from Lone Star ticks. And the pathogen that's in Lone Star ticks is not the rickettsia, not the Borrelia, it's the Ehrlichia. About 1 in 20 have that Ehrlichia. So it's a very abundant tick. It's the aggressive tick that chases you down. Ehrlichia chaffeensis is not common, but it's in about 1 in 50. There's another Ehrlichia that seems to potentially cause disease, but it's milder symptoms. So I will wrap it up. Just let me skip through a couple of slides here. So I've had students work on these various things, but I just want to finish off by saying, okay, so I just talked about how amblyomma is the most positive, most common tick. Very common in Tennessee. The main host is deer. So that brings us back full circle. So all those little black dots are, you know, if you don't usually hunt deer in the middle of summer, but if you did, that's what they look like, just covered in the Lone Star ticks. And then the final thing is, I have not talked at all about tick management, tick protection. That's something that we kind of get into in some of the later wildlife health courses, if any of you take that. But there is a very good website, tickencounter.org. If you go on there, there's a whole lot of advice on your protection, what kind of repellents to use, that kind of thing. There's a really nice mapping system that says, you know, if you are in the southeast in July, which tick species will you encounter? And when you click on the links, you get really nice photos, kind of like the ones I was showing you, of each of the life stages, and information on which ones are common, which ones are which. If you get a tick on, you go there and you'll see photos that will help you identify them. Okay, I will stop there because I know Dr. Strange wants to come up and give you a clicker thing, but I'll stick around afterwards, be happy to answer questions.
All right, let's give Graham a hand here. Come in. And after our clicker quiz, you know, do come up if you have a question, and I will get my computer fired up. Also, I had this up earlier, and I don't want to get started with this. This is our annual game supper, Saturday night. It's going to going to be over on the Ag Campus and the Science Arena. It's a lot of fun. All you have to do is bring $3 for the student club and eat all those kind of crazy game and fish. So